Most of you would have heard of R.C. Sproul. He's a very prominent and godly man who preaches in America. And he was interviewed once on a radio broadcast, and he was asked the question, what do non-Christian Americans need more than anything else today? And his answer was, they need to know God. And that was followed up by another question. So what do Christian Americans need more than anything else today? And his answer was exactly the same. They need to know God. And I think that's one of the great things about the book of Exodus. It's the world knows it as a book that tells us the beginnings of the nation of Israel and the great deliverance from Egypt, and they sing all sorts of romantic songs about it all, and it's gone down into folklore. But what we as Christians should remember more than anything else about the book of Exodus is that it teaches us amazing things about our God. It has much more to teach us than things about the ancient roots of Israel. It's here in Exodus that we're assured that God's loving and intimate involvement in the lives and affairs of his people is something that we can rely on. It's here in Exodus that we get our first glimpse and understandings of the great deliverance that God has planned not just for Israel, but for all his covenant people down through the centuries and down through time. And it's here that we get our first breathtaking glimpse of the plan of redemption that God has in mind for each one of us. A plan of salvation that we know reaches its glorious climax in the death of Jesus Christ, the Lamb of God, who takes away the sins of the world. So as we look at these few verses this morning, I want us to be focusing not on Israel and the things of Israel, but on God and the things pertaining to God, the things that we learn about God. And I want us to start looking at verse 23 from chapter 2. We all know what's gone on before that, how Israel, way back in the days of Abraham, went down into Egypt to escape the famine, and they were protected there through God's providential placement of Joseph. How that after Joseph died, they grew as a nation within Egypt, and the Egyptians became afraid of them and started to persecute them because they saw them as a national threat. How they ended up enslaving them, just as God had predicted. And finally, just before these events take place, we're told about the fact that the Pharaoh had decided that every male Hebrew child was to be killed at birth, and that Moses' parents had hidden him, and Moses had ended up in the palace of Pharaoh and been educated as an Egyptian prince. All of these things are just immediately prior to what we're looking at here in verse 23 of chapter 2, where it says, during that long period the king of Egypt died, and the Israelites groaned in their slavery and cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God. God heard their groaning, and he remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. So God looked on the Israelites, and God was concerned about them. I want us to pick up on two things this morning as we look for a few moments at these verses. The first is that we have a God who is compassionate, and we have a God who is powerful. It's one of the things that strikes us here is that Exodus chapter 2 verse 23 marks a distinct turning point in the affairs of Israel and in the revelation that's unfolding. For 400 years, God has been silent. God's voice has not been heard. There has been no revelation. And to all intents and purposes, Israel is a tiny, forsaken, powerless ethnic minority living in a country where they're at the mercy of a brutal superpower. And if God existed at all, he existed in memory and folklore and history. To the Israelites of the day, he appeared to be remote and disengaged and powerless. And the cries of the Israelites seemed to float off mockingly into empty silence. And there's nothing to relieve their despair. There's nothing to give them hope. But we see here in these verses that despite all the appearances, God is there. And God breaks the silence of 400 centuries in the passage, these few verses that we're looking at this morning, as he appears directly to Moses in the miraculous burning of the bush. And we learn these two wonderful things about our God. Now we see here in verse 23 that despite the passing time, the Israelites have continued groaning and crying out for help because of their slavery. And we learn in verse 24 that God heard. God wasn't deaf to the cries of his people. Even though they'd been praying and praying and praying and there'd been no obvious action from God or appearance from God or voice from God, God heard. God was listening. Their cries did not fall on deaf ears. Their cries were not wasted. God heard their cry, God heard their groaning, and God remembered. God remembered what? God remembered his covenant commitment. God remembered his covenant promises. God remembered his promises to Abraham and to Isaac and to Jacob. And that's important. We read that because of that, so God looked on the Israelites and was concerned about them. These were God's covenant people. God had made a commitment to them. God had made promises to them, promises that God was going to keep. God cared passionately and deeply about these people because they were his covenant people. They were no holy bunch, these Israelites. We learn later on, as the scriptures tell us more and more about their sojourn in Egypt, that they had forsaken God, that they were worshipping the pagan gods of Egypt, that they were indulging in the pagan and immoral lifestyle of Egypt. They were well and truly compromised spiritually by the society they lived in. And so when God heard their cries and God remembered and God looked on them and God responded to them, it wasn't because they were such wonderful people. They were flawed people. God looked on them and God remembered and God was moved with compassion and concern about them because they were his covenant people. There's immediately a tremendous challenge in that for us and a tremendous comfort in that for us. There are lots of people out there today, if they think about God at all, who just decide and they say quite irreverently that it's God's job to forgive, it's God's job to love people, that God embraces everybody, that God cares about everybody, that God is a God of love, and it doesn't matter what we do or what religion we belong to or what happens in our lives, when we die, we go to heaven. David Cook calls it justification by death. Doesn't matter what a person's life has been like, you go along to their funeral and they are definitely going to heaven and they're up there playing football or drinking with their mates or whatever it is that people imagine. But that's not what the Bible tells us about God and his love for people at all. God was deeply moved with compassion for these people in their pain and the things that were happening in their lives, but it was because they were his covenant people. And that's the challenge. Don't take it for granted that God loves you. Don't take it for granted that God cares about you. Don't take it for granted that God is providing for you if you are not one of his covenant people. Well, Robert, for goodness sakes, what on earth does all that mean? I'm not a Jew. I'm not Jewish. I haven't got Jewish answers. It doesn't matter. Because the Bible tells us that the covenant promises are extended to Jew and Gentile alike through faith in Jesus Christ, the Son of God. That we become children of Abraham by faith. We become members of the covenant by faith. And how does that spell out in everyday life for people here in Melbourne today? It means that when God works in our heart and God makes us conscious of our sin and our shortcomings and our flaws and our faults and of the rubbish in our lives. And having made us aware of that, makes us also aware that Jesus Christ is God's Son who died on the cross to take the responsibility and the shame and the guilt of our sin before God. If we understand that and put our trust and faith in what Christ did, we are embraced into the covenant. We become part of the eternal family of God that he makes these promises and commitments to. And I guess the first challenge is, where are you this morning? Have you acknowledged your sinfulness before God? Are you aware of your sinfulness in the eyes of God? Have you cried out to God and asked for forgiveness, asked for reconciliation, asked to be part of God's family? And have you done that being aware that that can happen for you? Because when Christ died on the cross, he was punished for the sins of those that God would bring into his covenant. And that applied to Abraham's, way back in Abraham's day, just as much as it applies to us today. So we confess our sin to God. We ask God to forgive us. We ask God to love us and embrace us and take us into his family, not because we're good people, not because we're better than the Egyptians, the society we live in, but because Christ died and paid the penalty for our sin. And God will forgive those who take refuge in that. So these things apply to us not because we're good people, not because we're Aussies, not because we live in the Western world, not because we're good citizens, not because we barrack for Hawthorne, but because Christ died for us. And God has made us part of his covenant and taken us into that. So God looked on these people and God was concerned for them because they were his covenant people and he had made commitments to them that he would never break, even though they would be undeserving and rebellious and pig-headed and would sin again and again and again and follow after other gods. God would not forsake them. He would not break his covenant promises to them. And so we see this wonderful and compassionate God. And this is reinforced in chapter 7 when God reveals himself to Moses and speaks to Moses and he says, I have indeed seen the misery of my people in Egypt. I've heard them crying out because of their slave drivers and I'm concerned about their suffering. So I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. God had not forgotten his people. And no matter what the outward appearances were, God still heard. God still knew. God still cared. And God was still going to act on behalf of his people and fill out his plans for them. So what does all this have to do to you and me? What's the encouragement in this for us, beside the challenges? Well, firstly, and we've already touched on it, that God hears the cries of his covenant people because they are his covenant people. He heard the cries of the Israelites, not because of their goodness, but because he had set his love upon them, a love that he would never withdraw. They would never be forsaken. He would never leave them. Having adopted them into his family, he was totally committed to them for all eternity, to do good things for them, to transform their lives, to work in them, to work through them, to make them glorious, eventually in eternity. And in Christ we're included in those promises. One of the great lies that Satan loves to come to us is to whisper in our ears that we don't deserve the love of God. I don't know what's going on in your life. You don't know what goes on in my life. You don't know what happens behind the facade that's on the front. You don't know my thought life. You don't know anything about me. But we're all in the same boat. We're all sinful people. We all fall far short of the glory of God. And one of the great tricks that Satan has is to tell us that these promises don't really apply to us because we're not good people. We're stubborn. We're rebellious. We're self-centered. There are things in our lives that we wouldn't want other people to know about. Why would God hear your cries for help? Why would God be interested in your shabby, shoddy little life? Why would God care about somebody who's got things in their lives that they would be ashamed for other people to know about? And of course, those things are true. But isn't that why Christ needed to die on the cross? Aren't they the very sins, the very things that Jesus died for and took the punishment for, paid the price for, so that we could be forgiven, so that we could be dressed in the righteousness of Christ? God knows what's going on in your life. God knows your circumstances. God knows where you work. He knows how hard it may be to be a Christian in the place where you work. God knows the society you live in. God knows the rubbish, the pornography, the stuff that comes into your home week after week on the television and through the internet. God knows the temptations and the pressures that are out there in the world around us to compromise our faith, to throw our lot in with the world, to be the kind of things that they want the church and they want Christians to be. God knows that society wants us to agree with them and to approve of their agenda and approve of what they're doing. God knows all of that. And God knows the cry of our hearts. God knows the struggle that we go through. And even though it may appear at times that God is not doing much, God hears, God sees, God knows, and God cares, because we are his covenant people. Don't believe Satan's lie that God won't work powerfully in your life because you're not worthy of it. That's works. And our God is a God of grace, a God who acts graciously, and a God who intervenes in our lives, a God who does great things for us. So understand that we have such a God. And even if your heart is condemning you this morning and you're thinking, well, the trouble is not with God, the trouble is with me, remember that you have a God of grace, a God who loves his covenant people, who remembers how frail we are and says that as far as the east is from the west, so far has he removed our sins from us. And we can trust that. We can trust God to love us and to keep caring for us, no matter how bad we might feel. God does hear our cries and God is concerned. He says the Israelites groaned in their slavery and they cried out, and their cry for help because of their slavery went up to God, and God heard their groaning and God remembered his covenant and God was concerned about them. God cares about you. God cares about the struggles in your lives. God knows the plans that he has for you. But it's not enough for God to be compassionate. And I'm turning now to chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. It's not enough for God to hear the cries of our hearts. It's not enough for God to know our circumstances. It's not enough for God to watch over us and be concerned about us if he's powerless to do anything. My son is an AFES worker. And he was admiring a beautiful bespoke, I love, well, that's the first time I've been able to publicly use this word bespoke that we hear so much about on television these days. I didn't even know what it was till I looked it up in the dictionary. But anyway, I've got this beautiful bespoke set of bookcases in my lounge room. They were made for me by a Dutch craftsmen when I was living in Tasmania. They are beautifully made from Tasmanian oak with skillfully made concealed dovetailed joints and adjustable shelving. They are marvellous. Everybody comments on my bookcases. So if you come to my house, just remember to say something nice about them. My son has got books climbing up the walls of his study. There are books everywhere, great piles of them on the floor, and he desperately needs some bookcases. And he looked at my bookcases and he was wondering how much it would cost to get someone to build him a set just like mine. Well, I can tell you now, there's no way in the world he could afford to pay to have someone build such a set of bookcases. And I felt really sorry for him. I was moved with compassion, and impulsively, on the spur of the moment, I told him that I would build him a set, just like mine. And I lay awake for a good part of that night, worrying about my rashness. I haven't made a dovetail joint since I was in grade 7 at high school. I have no idea how I will honour my promise. I have no idea how I'll be able to build a set of bookcases for him. You see, it's one thing to make the promise. It's another thing entirely to be able to deliver. One thing for God to be a God of compassion. One thing for God to listen and see and care and promise to do something about the things in our lives where we need help. It's another thing altogether for God to have the power to deliver. And it was critical for Israel, it was critical for Moses, and it's critical for you and me that God has the power to deliver on his promises. All the encouraging things I've said to you about the covenant promises of God are meaningless unless God is powerful. Unless God is the Almighty. And that's the significance for us of what follows in the opening verses here in chapter 3. We see in verse 1 that Moses is looking after his father-in-law's sheep, and he leads them across to the far side of the desert where there's better pickings, and he sees a bush burning fiercely but not getting burnt up. And he's very curious and goes to see what's happening. And we're told in verse 2 that the angel of the Lord appeared to him. And then again in verse 4 that the Lord saw him and that God called to him. And of course we need to understand that the angel of the Lord in verse 2 is the Lord and the God of verses 4, 5 and 7. God is present. And God speaks to Moses and tells him that he needs to take off his sandals because he's standing on holy ground. Holy, purely and simply because Moses is in the presence of God. God is there. And Moses is in the presence of Israel's holy and powerful covenant-keeping God, and he hides his face because he's afraid to look at God, we're told in verse 7. And God says to Moses what we've already learned in verses 24 through to 25 in chapter 2, that he is the God of the covenant, that he has indeed seen the misery of his people in Egypt, that he's heard them crying out and is concerned about their suffering. And then he adds something wonderful that's not revealed in verses 24 and 25. That he's come down to rescue the people from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land and take them to a good and spacious land flowing with milk and honey. A land of peace, a land of prosperity. More evidence of God's compassion, more declarations of God's good intentions. But can God deliver? That's the issue. Can God be as good as his word? Yes, he can. One burning bush, defying all the known laws of physics and chemistry, testifies, yes, he can. And that's the purpose of the miracle, that Moses and all who later burned about what had happened, that's the purpose of the miracle, they will be convinced that the Lord of creation is able to deliver, that he has the power to do so. And boy, did Israel need a God who could deliver on his promises. Enslaved by the most powerful nation on earth, enslaved by the sinful lifestyle of that nation, enslaved by the pagan gods of that nation. Nothing short of a miracle would rescue them from the plight they were in. And we need a God just as powerful to rescue us. Moses and Israel wouldn't get much mileage out of a God who was filled with compassion for a hurting people, but lacked the power to deliver on his promises and his concerns. Israel needed a God who could do miraculous things. Israel needed a God who was in control in the real world. A God who could intervene and change the whole universe if he wanted to. A God who is part of everyday life, part of the real cut and thrust in the world of time and space and matter. A God who wrote the laws of physics and chemistry in the first place and thoroughly understands everything about them and can overrule them when he pleases. A God who can do amazing things for his people. What Israel needed desperately was a real God who could reach into the real world and effect a real rescue from the real predicament they were in. And that's the kind of God we need. A God who is so vast, so awesome, so powerful, so infinitely intelligent that he can do anything. Whether it fits in with the currently known understandings of the laws of chemistry and physics or not. A miracle-working God. A God who, despite all appearances of the contrary, knows what's going on in the lives of his people, knows what's going on in his world, knows what's going on in the life of the church, and will act to fulfill his promises and his commitments. It's not a new and different God who is made known to Moses that day. It's the God of his forefathers, the God of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And there's no new plan, but simply the outworking of the old plan revealed to Abraham back in Genesis 15. Remember? When God said, "Know for certain," saying this to Abraham, "that your descendants will be strangers in a country not their own, and they will be enslaved and mistreated 400 years. But I will punish the nation they serve as slaves, and afterwards they will come out with great possessions." And isn't that really what God is talking about when he says to Moses in verse 7, "I have indeed seen the misery of my people. I've heard them crying. I'm concerned about their suffering, so I've come down to rescue them from the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of that land into a good and spacious land, a land flowing with milk and honey. I've seen the way the Egyptians are oppressing them, so now go. I'm sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt." We need to know our God. We live in hard times in many ways for the church. We live in a society that is increasingly undermining and destroying, eroding, casting off the foundations on which our society has been built. The Judeo-Christian ethics and morality that has shaped our society for the first couple of hundred years of its existence. a time when the church was respected in the community, and to be a minister was a thing of honour. Today the church is on the nose. Ministers are suspect and treated with contempt in many cases. Our parliaments are undoing the moral and ethical foundations on which our society has been built. We are becoming a secular, humanistic nation. And God appears to be silent. God appears to be impotent. God appears not to care. These wicked people proceed on their path unchecked. And Christians are beginning to wonder, is God really there? Is God real, or so-called Christians, is God really listening? Does God really care? And people say that we're living in the post-Christian era, we're witnessing the death throes of the church in the Western world. And I say to you, rubbish. We have a God who loves his covenant people, a God who will honour and keep his promises, a God who will work his purposes out through the church and through his people right through to eternity. A God who has made promises to love and to care and to listen and to work in the lives of his people. And a God who has demonstrated again and again and again that he has the power to do so. Don't be ashamed of your God. Don't be daunted by the arrogance and the defiance of the world around you. But take your stand with the Apostle Paul, who wrote in Romans chapter 1 verse 16, I am not ashamed of the gospel of Christ. Why? Because it is the power of God unto salvation for everyone who believes. And people will still believe. When we faithfully go to people and present to them the gospel, talk to them about Jesus, model his love and his salvation in our lives, God will reach into the lives of people one at a time, individual after individual, and make them part of his covenant family through faith in Jesus Christ. Our God is powerful. Our God hears, our God knows, and our God knows exactly what his promises are, and he will keep them. Trust him.